We've done introductions before in the other meetings. We had the Legal Aid South African, Legal Aid South Africa, and the department yesterday. But I think everybody knows, I mean, each other. From the committee's side, we're a bit short-staffed. The reason I'm chairing is that Mr. Ramachodi is in the Judicial Service Commission hearings, so he's not available. There's also the Constitutional Review Committee is on a study trip, so Chairperson, I'm sure you'll be very disappointed to know that the Honourable Smuts is, rather than decided not to miss the chance of listening to your report, and instead went to Venice. So that's where she is now. So I'm sure you're a bit disappointed, but basically that's why we short staffed from the committee side. But it's then over to you. I shouldn't be saying this to the Human Rights Commission, but it is a slightly different process this time because it's not just an examination of the annual report, but also a budget review. So we can, in terms of the Money Bills and Related Procedures Amendment Act, make recommendations to the House regarding funding. I can see the acting CFO's eyes lighting up, and as I said, it's not something one should have really informed the Commission beforehand, because I know you always complain you don't have enough money, but that is one of the aspects that we can look at and can put in our report. But Chairperson, then over to you. Is a presentation, or there are a number of documents which were circulated beforehand, and there is also a analysis from the research unit. Chairperson, over to you. Welcome, and over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and honorable members. And once again, thanks very much for this opportunity to appear before you to present, to make a presentation on our annual report. With me is the CEO, Mr. Kayumi, you know. And in our last presentation, we had the Chief Financial Officer was just a month with us, and unfortunately he resigned before he even finished 1 month. So we have Martha, who is an acting Chief Financial Officer, and the Deputy Chairperson, Press Kavenda, is with us, and accept the apologies of our colleagues, the other commissioners, and precisely because of financial constraints. They are not even able to attend, and you will note when we raise it at the end of this, because we don't want to interrupt the presentation. We are cash strapped. We even asked for a postponement of this presentation because of finances. But the CEO will take us through the presentation on the strategic objectives, and there will be a few points that we'd want to raise right at the end of the presentation. We don't want to interrupt the presentation. Over to you, CEO.
CEO, I mean, on a not really a lighter note, but I did notice that the quality of the paper in your annual report took account of the finances, but there's no color, and it's sort of lighter quality paper. If you look at possibly your better, she's coming tomorrow, your better resource public protector, it's nice, shiny paper, and lots of color pictures. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members. Even my tie is a little thinner today as a reflection and symbolic of the lean financial state that we're currently in. But enough about the finances. My task here today is to talk a little bit about the annual report 2009-2010. As members of Parliament are aware, I joined the Commission just over 2.5 months ago, and as the Chairperson indicated, the CFO has resigned. We joined at the same time. He resigned a month later, and so currently we have Masa, who is the acting CFO, with us today. So the purpose of this presentation is to take you through briefly the annual report. You have the full annual report, I understand, with you. But the Commission has also developed a document which summarizes the annual report, and that was distributed together with this presentation earlier this week. The report is meant to be a summary and an overview of the annual report, and certainly it's not comprehensive. Now, our presentation consists of three sections. Firstly, there's the overall analysis of our performance against predetermined objectives. It highlights both the overall achievements and the challenges that the Commission encountered in achieving its objectives. Secondly, we have a review of the service delivery environment, and it reviews how the Commission has been performing in fulfilling its mandate. Thirdly, the institutional environment is assessed, and we provide a summary of the key areas of performance, including human resources, information technology, and communications and publications. At the end of the presentation, I will also talk a little bit about what our plans are as the Commission to try and deal with some of the challenges which I'm going to be highlighting based on our 2009-2010 annual report. In terms of the overall analysis, one of the major challenges that we faced as a Commission during the last financial year was that only 52% of the Commission's objectives were achieved. And this is clearly unacceptable and highly problematic. Part of the problem is clearly financial constraints, human resource constraints, and IT challenges. But another component of the problem, which is fairly complex, is that targets set for the programs in the Commission have also been problematic. You'll notice when I get to our monitoring and promotion mandate that there are hundreds of workshops which we've targeted for the financial year, and clearly, based on our financial and human resource constraints, we will not be able to meet those targets even in this current financial year. So in anticipation of this, we are actually planning to have a midterm strategic review tomorrow where the commissioners and senior managers will focus on how we are able to revise our performance targets and objectives for this current financial year. So budget constraints, just to maybe touch a little bit about that, the delivery of the Commission's objectives was severely constrained by our financial resources, and several targets were not achieved. Most notably, the PAIA Section 32 report did not include a report on private bodies. The internal audit program did not have audit projects in provincial offices, and we also were unable to appoint a risk manager as advised by the audit committee. What we have done as an interim measure is for the office manager in the office of the CEO to take over risk management responsibilities. It's clearly not ideal, but these are some of the creative measures that we have put in place to try and deal with the challenges, financial challenges we face. On a positive note, we managed to receive a clean audit, and this is due entirely to the work of my predecessor, the acting CEO, and currently the deputy CEO, Nalidzani Makwebo. There were no matters of emphasis indicated in the audit report, but the Auditor General had raised concerns about our performance, and at least the lack of our performance, which I've spoken to early on. An additional broader problem which we are currently dealing with at senior management level is the question of leadership and management. The acting CEO and CFO, which was in place for nearly a year, the transition of a new set of commissioners that joined us a year ago during this financial period under review, have clearly been part of the reasons for the lack of performance. And we hope to address some of these challenges in the next couple of weeks and months, although I must indicate again that the performance targets for 2010-2011 will most likely also be inadequate, and hopefully the changes implemented now will only be seen most likely in 2012-2013. Moving on to our overall financial performance, you will notice that in the report provided that the actual expenditure for 2009-2010 was 72.6 million, which included depreciation on assets amounting to just under 2.5 million. And the total commitment for which no provision was raised was 887,000. And while the budget has steadily increased over the last 5 years, most of those increases are absorbed by salary increases as well as inflation. And currently, we do sit with a problem where we are unable to fulfill many of the requirements of mandate of the Constitution, or mandate of the Commission as articulated in the Constitution. I want to point out that if one looks at the personnel costs and compares that from 2005, 2006 to 2009, 2010, you'll see that there's nearly been a doubling in our personnel costs over the past five financial years. But the question that must be asked is, are we getting the necessary value for money? I'm not entirely convinced that we are using our personnel effectively and that we are using our resources effectively, and I acknowledge that this is a major challenge on the part of the Commission, which I am currently addressing. One of the ways in which we are addressing this challenge is through a restructuring process, which I embarked upon about 3 weeks ago, and this is attempting to address some of these financial and human resource constraints, and also trying to make the most of the individuals that we have at the Commission. By mid-December, we hope to have a better sense of what we need and how we are able to spend and utilize our personnel and human resources. My colleague, Masa, the acting CFO, will be able to provide more details about the financial situation. Now, one of the things we've tried to do at the Commission is to limit spending. So, for example, there are small things which we've done. Commissioners, myself, and all staff have now agreed that we will only fly economy class. So these are small measures that we've taken to try and reduce financial expenditure. There are also bigger things that we've done. We've frozen a number of posts. Over the past 6 weeks that I've been in office, we've had three provincial managers resigning. I hope it's not as a result of my arrival. But generally, this is part of the problem. So what we've done is to try and freeze those posts, and we've utilized people who are in the Commission and try to move them into those posts. So again, those are some of the ways in which we are trying to reduce our overall costs. You also notice in the report that we received some donor funding from various organizations. I just want to point out point C, the Raoul Wallenberg Institute. There was certain money, 27,531 rand, that was not used. The reason for this is really because of the effectiveness of the project itself and the ability to utilize the resources that were allocated to us fairly effectively. In the Atlantic Philanthropies money that we received, the balance was eventually utilized by the end of the 30th of April, which is not reflected, of course, in our current annual report, which only speaks of expenditure until the 31st of March 2010. But we need to look generally more seriously at donor funding. Treasury, in our meeting with them a few weeks ago, had said to us, quote unquote, that the taps have been turned off. So we are clearly looking at donor funding as a viable alternative, but we do realize that it takes almost a year between the time we apply for donor funding to the time that we actually receive the money. So this is a long-term attempt to try and deal with some of the financial inadequacies that we have in our budget. But as I indicated, my colleague Marcel will be happy to touch on some of those in more detail if questions are posed to him on that area. With respect to governance and compliance for the 2009-2010 year, the period under review for internal audit was performed by our internal auditors in line with the PFMA requirements. The internal audit activity provides the audit committee and management with assurance that the internal controls are appropriate and effective, and this is achieved by means of objective appraisal and evaluation of various risk management processes. And as I indicated, because we don't have a risk manager at the moment, that has led to certain challenges, but at least we recognize that we have the necessary internal controls and governance processes in place, and we have identified various corrective action that needs to be taken to ensure that we, again, achieve a clean audit for the current financial year. The internal audit activity is fully supported by management, the commissioners, and the audit committee, and has full unrestricted access to all organizational activities, records, property, and personnel. In terms of internal controls, the controls throughout the Commission focus on the critical risk areas identified by the operational risk management, confirmed by management, and again assessed by the auditors. The controls are designed to provide cost-effective assurance that assets are safeguarded and that the available working capital is managed effectively and economically. In terms of risk management, the Commission has been unable to appoint a risk manager, as I indicated earlier, due to financial constraints, and the office manager in my office is currently looking at this. Again, we are trying to try and utilize staff very effectively, although it has resulted in certain instances of staff being overutilized, but we are trying to manage this process through the restructuring initiatives which has been initiated in the last couple of weeks. And then lastly, in terms of the Audit Committee, the Commission's Audit Committee continues to function, met 5 times during the period under review. The Audit Committee, as you are aware, is responsible for improving management reporting systems by overseeing the audit functions, internal controls, and the financial reporting processes. I'm also happy to announce that we have recently appointed 2 new Audit Committee members who will be joining us at our next Audit Committee on the 27th of October. In terms of the service delivery environment, we have, in the 2009-2010 financial year, conducted 74 community outreach interventions, 371 presentations, 182 radio interventions, and 24 seminars, the details of which are captured in the annual report. But the question, I must be honest, that I've been asking my colleagues is, what is behind the numbers? So it's quite impressive that we've done all of these things, but how effective have these promotional activities been? In my view, the Commission has in the past been very numbers-driven in terms of trying to ensure community outreach interventions, and this has to some extent been effective, but I question how effective these interventions are when we deal with the communities who are affected by these interventions. And so what we are taking into account for the current financial year is to look at monitoring and evaluation mechanisms to try and monitor and evaluate the effectiveness of these interventions. And this is a criticism of the Commission which is currently being addressed by myself and colleagues in senior management. In terms of parliamentary liaison, the Commission and its Parliamentary and International Affairs Program had anticipated the Chapter 9 unit, which has now only been established a few weeks ago. Consequently, the program conducted introductory briefing sessions with the Portfolio Committee on Women, Children, and Persons with Disabilities. The briefing was on various international treaty bodies that have an impact on the work of the committee. The Commission also had an opportunity to brief the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Correctional Services on the work that the organization conducts in advocating for South Africa to comply with its international obligations on the matter of torture. Some of the developments that have taken place since this report is the establishment of the Office for Institutions Supporting Democracy, and we've been working closely with this office since establishment a few weeks ago, which has enhanced our relationship with Parliament. In terms of our protection mandate, the Commission has received and recorded 9,326 complaints in the 2009-2010 financial year. Of this total, 3,639 were accepted as prima facie human rights violations, requiring further investigation. The total number of complaints finalized during this period was 1,429. Again, this has led to our poor performance of 52%. It's clearly a reflection of some of the challenges, both capacity and financial. But also beyond that, our complaints handling mechanism, which has been a bit of a problem and is currently under review and will be discussed again at our midterm strategic review session, which is taking place tomorrow. What we've tried to do to manage the number of complaints that we received and are unable to deal with is to collaborate with other institutions supporting democracy, such as the Commission on Gender Equality and the Public Protector, and we are working towards trying to streamline our complaints handling system so that there is less of a burden placed on the Commission and we are able to pool the resources with other institutions supporting democracy to be able to provide an effective and efficient service to our complainants. In terms of redress for human rights violations, during the period under review, a total of 17 equality cases were litigated. There were no public impact cases focusing on the rights of the child that was litigated on. Now, in the past, I know that litigation has been one of those mechanisms which the Commission has been asked to use more effectively. The low litigation rate, again, was due to a lack of resources and high vacancy rates within the LSP. And in order to address these resource constraints, both human and financial, the program conducted a collaborative agreement in the form of memoranda of understanding with external firms regarding pro bono litigation and services. So again, this is one of the creative ways we are trying to deal with our financial constraints by working with others and collaborating with private and other ISD institutions to try and provide an effective service. But questions are now being asked within the Commission and amongst commissioners whether litigation is the most appropriate and most effective way of dealing with complaints. And so the value of litigation is being questioned. We know that it's very expensive and it takes a considerable amount of time and it may have a limited impact. So there is a need, in my view, to move beyond this culture of litigation and to look at more productive ways of utilizing the Commission's time and resources, and particularly focusing on things like mediation and dialogue. Ultimately, the Commission, is meant to do two things. Our mandate is to keep government in check, but also, secondly, and very importantly, to transform society. And so can we transform society effectively through litigation? Our view is that we are reviewing this, we are looking at alternative mechanisms for dealing with complaints, and litigation is certainly one of them, but should not be the primary mechanism for dealing with these complaints. I also want to indicate that the Parliamentary and International Affairs Programme, in terms of our protection of human rights mandate, has made a number of submissions on human rights, including trafficking, domestic violence, child justice, and service delivery. The Commission notably made 10 legislative submissions that are highlighted on pages 12 to 13 of the annual report. Monitoring of human rights, we conducted successful public hearings on economic and social rights in terms of Section 184(3) of the Constitution. The economic and social rights report is currently being finalized. In fact, it has now been finalized and will be submitted to Parliament in mid-November. The ESR report focuses on the obviously economic and social rights, and the public hearings have been quite effective. But it's important to note that the hearings had to be postponed due to a lack of responsiveness on the part of government departments. And several requests for information on the progressive realization of economic and social rights were not acceded to by government. There was a lack of response to the invitation to present on the part of government at our public hearings, and we simply wanted to highlight this at this portfolio committee. Possibly there are ways in which the PC can assist us in this general problem that we have in engaging with certain government departments. In terms of equality and non-discrimination, the Commission, through its racism and non-discrimination portfolio, helped draft the National Action Plan to combat racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance. And then in April 2009, the Commission launched its health report, which presented the findings of a public inquiry into the state of health care services in the South African public health sector. The event was attended by members of civil society, as well as representatives from government departments, including the Deputy DG of the Department of Health. And the report provided recommendations for improving the public health care system. The implementation of these recommendations are now closely being monitored by the Commission. Something which has been very positive is that the chairperson has already had a meeting with the Minister of Health on some of the recommendations which have been made in the health report, and we plan to have a follow-up meeting with the Minister later this month to discuss these findings, as well as some of the new complaints that have been received and submitted to us. In particular, I want to note a complaint received from one of our Democratic Alliance members of Parliament, Honourable Waters, on child mortality rates, which is also going to be discussed at our meeting with the Minister later this month. The promotion of access to information mandate, which I must say our PAEA program consists of two individuals with a really small budget of 180,000, but despite these financial and human resource constraints, we're able to conduct 4 audits, 36 training workshops, and 1 seminar. We received 208 legal assistance requests, 71 were from public bodies, 57 from private bodies, and 80 from various individuals. And we also, during the 2009-2010 financial year, managed to hold our first regional Indaba for information officers in KZN. One of the current issues that we plan to discuss during our midterm review, which takes place tomorrow, is the future of the PAIA mandate at the Commission. We've engaged informally with Honorable Jeffrey during a PAIA workshop we held 2 weeks ago, and we've also had discussions with people such as Alison Tilley from ODAC, and questions have been asked about the enforcement mechanism of PAIA. So, and the idea, I think, is to try and shift some of the responsibilities relating to PAIA to the information regulator. This is something which we are currently engaging on, and we'll have some more substantive discussions on during the course of our midterm strategic review tomorrow, where the Commission should be able to formulate a more long-term approach to the PAIA mandate. In terms of institutional environment, and these are coming to the end of the annual report specifically, human resources, I've already indicated some of the challenges there, but in the meantime, we've managed to develop a human resource plan. We have a recruitment and selection strategy which is being implemented, as well as a staff development strategy. The staff development strategy has ensured that 83 members of staff were trained in various areas. 5 staff members were awarded bursaries during the last financial year, and 28 newly appointed staff members were inducted in line with the training program. The retention of senior staff is a major challenge for us at the Commission. As I indicated earlier, 3 provincial managers, as well as the chief financial officer, resigned within the space of 6 weeks after my arrival. Now, again, I would like to believe it's not because of my arrival that they resigned. One of the ways in which we're trying to address this is through the restructuring process, which I alluded to earlier on. And the restructuring process has been a difficult and challenging way of dealing with this. If we looked at short-term measures to reallocate resources and staff within the Commission, and by mid-December, we should have a good sense of where we are going in terms of Commission and in terms of our structure, trying to make it more lean, more effective, and we should be able to report back to the Portfolio Committee on this. In terms of information technology, which has been a significant challenge for us, part of the problem with IT has been structural. I think the way in which IT is structured at the Commission is problematic. Part of the problem is financial. We clearly don't have sufficient resources to buy the necessary equipment and software to provide to cater to the needs of the Commission. We also have a skills deficit, so that the current individuals who are employed at IT have not undergone sufficient training. And the AG has complained about the lack of compliance in certain respects with respect to IT. So these are some of the challenges we're dealing with and have been addressing in the last couple of weeks. The good news is that our website is finally up and running. There's some very nice pictures of Commissioner Mashwana and Commissioner Govinda on the website, which I'd encourage you to have a look at. Finally, in terms of communications and publications, which has also been a major challenge for us, and we are looking in the restructuring process to dealing with the ICP program. But some of the successes have been the 2009 annual report. As Honorable Jeffries has indicated, the quality of the report and the paper is a reflection perhaps of the state of affairs financially, but also I think of our program, and clearly we need to look at this. But a number of reports, which I won't go through, have been highlighted. As indicated, again, part of the problem with this program is structural and financial, and we will hopefully be able to deal with the ICP program more specifically in the next 2 weeks. In terms of addressing challenges, and this is the end of the discussion around the annual report for 2009-2010, I'd now like to turn to how we are going to be dealing with these challenges going forward. The various strategic planning sessions have been indicated for the next couple of weeks. We start off with our midterm strategic review, which is taking place tomorrow, and one of the reasons why we had requested a postponement of this meeting was so that we could finalize the discussions at the meeting of the midterm review and then perhaps present some of those findings to you, but this, of course, is not possible. The commissioners are planning a strategic workshop in mid-November, We have a strategic review planned for the end of November. And then the restructuring process, which I've spoken about, the first phase will be concluded by mid-December this year, the second phase by February 2011. So we should have a good sense of where the Commission is heading to in the next couple of months. Ideally, it would be helpful. I'm not sure when the Portfolio Committee plans to invite us to present again. We would ideally either want to present to you in December sometime or either early next year, so that we have some time to implement the changes which we are looking at trying to do in the next couple of months, and to be able to then present something more concretely to you when we eventually meet next time. The short-term focus, which was discussed during our plenary meeting a few weeks ago, and this is from August 2010, from the time I arrived to March 2011, which is the end of the current financial year, is to focus on three areas. Firstly, restructuring, and this is the resource allocation which I spoke of, both at a financial and human resource level, and also to develop consultative fora within the Commission. We have established excellent relationships with the commissioners, with the various stakeholders in the Commission, with provinces, head office, with the union representatives. Secondly, to focus on our relationship with commissioners, and this is the relationship between commissioners and the secretariat. We understand and acknowledge that the PFMA and the South African Human Rights Commission Act have some inconsistencies with respect to who should be doing what in terms of commissioners versus the CEO. And so we are trying to develop meaningful consultations on this and looking at developing a charter which sets out clearly the and distinguishes the relationship between commissioners and the secretariat. And thirdly, and very importantly, in the short term, we want to strengthen our relationship with Parliament. As I indicated, the Office for Institutions Supporting Democracy has been a huge help for us as a commission. I know that the office is in its infancy stages, but already our engagement with the office has been very positive. We also, of course, want to strengthen our relationship with this portfolio committee, as well as engaging with other Chapter 9 institutions to ensure collaboration in the way in which we deal with Parliament. The medium-term focus from the beginning of the next financial year to November is to look at our strategic realignment. Current strategic plan has some challenges, and we need to try and align the strategic plan with our resources as well as with the commissioner's focus for the next 5 to 7 years. The idea is that we need to consider both our human and financial resource constraints, look at our strategy, and try and find congruence between the strategic realignment process as well as the resources which we currently have as a commission. The restructuring process is, of course, an ongoing process, and so it will continue for at least the next 18 months. And during that time, we hope to conduct an organizational review and, again, focus on developing consultative fora within the commission as well as with external stakeholders. And this brings me to the third point, which is our external relations. We want to certainly strengthen our relationship with Parliament, with the media, with other Chapter 9s and stakeholders. We have come to realize that the people who come to us on a daily basis and the 9,000 complaints we received in the last financial year is clearly a reflection of the value that we add as a commission to society, but we need to engage with those individuals who come and see us and who come to request advice and guidance from us to get a sense of what they want from the commission. And I think to some extent that's been lacking in the way in which we formulated our strategic review process thus far, and it's hopefully something which I plan to focus on in the medium term. And then lastly, this is a more or less a roadmap for how we plan to look at short, medium, and long-term goals, which takes us from August 2010 all the way through to June 2012. On your left, you'll see all of the key areas that we want to focus on: restructuring, commissioners program, Parliament, strategic realignment, and then external relations. And we've indicated the reporting obligations to Parliament, which is highlighted with the dotted lines. This is a broad overview of the areas that we are going to be focusing on in the next couple of months. So with those few words, I want to thank the Portfolio Committee for giving us the opportunity to present. We acknowledge that more needs to be done, that the Commission has not been performing effectively, and I want to urge the committee to take into consideration the fact that while we have had a huge staff turnover and while we have serious financial constraints, we are in the process of trying to correct some of those. But unfortunately, because change takes a long time, we suspect that a lot of these changes are only going to be felt and seen in the 2012-2013 financial year. I understand that members of Parliament are eager to see the Commission do a good job and make a success and a meaningful contribution to society, and so do I. I mean, I certainly want to see exactly the same thing for the Commission. So I want to assure members of Parliament that we are working very hard to ensure that the Commission is able to achieve its mandate and to play a meaningful role in the transformation of our society. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, does anybody else want to add? Yourself, the Deputy Chair, the Acting CFO?
No.
Okay, all right. Deputy Chair?
I think thanks to our CEO for very thorough. I think just a question of how to strengthen the Commission. I think I would like to emphasize two things. The one is the issue of, obviously, finance, because finance is linked to the other areas, such as staff, retention of staff, for example, in the context of market-related salaries and the inability of the Commission to actually address that. The second is in relation to IT challenges, which is also linked to finance. But the other area, which is a critical area, is the area of what does Parliament do with our reports? And we've raised this several times, and we still don't have a response to a systematic report from Parliament as to what has happened to the Commission's report thus far. And we would appreciate that this committee actually leads in being able to give us that report. Thanks, Chair.
Questions, comments from members of the committee? Who wants to start? Debbie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a number of questions. Some of them may be, I don't know, I'm a new member here, so please forgive me if there's something I should know that I don't quite know yet. But can you just first explain what are the criteria that you actually use to decide whether something is a human rights violation or not? Do you have a set of standards that you use, and who actually makes that decision? Is it a committee, or is it one person, or what happens there? Secondly, am I correct in understanding that that report you said is coming, is that the 1834 report, the obligation, social rights report? You said that is coming to us, and you will explain then about who's complying and who's not. Okay. I also would like to see in your report some more detail regarding actual complaints. Obviously, you can't give us specifics on 2,000 complaints, but at least kind of categories of complaints that are taken on, refused, and so on. Just on your staff issue, you've mentioned how much your budget's gone up for staffing, but how many staff have actually been added to that? Can you give us your staff rates in 2006 and now? How much of that is actual extra staff, or is it just increases in salary? We can joke about the acting CFO's presence there, but seriously, why is there such a high staff turnover rate? Have you done exit interviews to find out? And I was very interested to know which government departments have not been cooperating with you in your endeavours. Please.
What we'll do is take a round. You can then respond. You can then take another round if there are more questions. But just note the questions rather than responding on a one-on-one basis. JV.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I want to thank the Human Rights Commission for the way in which they've prepared their report. More especially this document, the summaries, they provide an easy way of understanding your report. It is disheartening that I heard that two provinces, I mean provincial heads that have been have resigned, three. And then I want to ask, is Mpumalanga still on? There was an office at from Sanga, that was recently opened. That's my first question. And then my second question, I saw that there are also some, you call them interventions. I take it that those are the interviews with the radios. Who is conducting the interviews? Are these interviews also conducted in indigenous languages? I'm thinking of people who are from the rural areas, people staying behind the mountains, over the river, down the valley, etc., etc. And then my other question would be, there has been a, they call it a council, CAS, the one formed by Bongani Pichan and others. It was saying that they are going to be collaborating with the Chapter 9 institutions and the like. Have they already approached the Human Rights Commission? How do you see your future, maybe collaboration or working together with them? Thank you, Chairperson.
Llewellyn, anything at this point? No, okay. Just from my side, I think the same question on the complaints, and it's something I've raised before, and it was something I had expected to find in your annual report. But I would have thought what is important, particularly for the human, I mean, there's lots of places that people can go to for complaints, advice offices, LRCs, etc. You've got a statutory and a constitutional obligation to promote human rights and assist people who feel their rights have been violated. And whilst dealing with each individual case is important, I would have thought, particularly from the Commission, what is important is the trends and what can be done about those trends. So you might find people, say, who feel, well, let's take a more topical issue that's maybe not so popular among some of us, the issue of access to services at the municipal level. Okay, you're going to cover it. No, maybe it's a bad example because you're going to cover it in your social economic rights report, so let's leave that. Let's say, you know, you've got complaints from people about, home affairs. Okay. Now, you with the litigation side, you can ultimately take government to court. But the issue would be, look, and I think other MPs, we have, most of us would have a number of constituency home affairs matters, which you take up, but you get the sense that you're not, you get the problems addressed, but you're not necessarily that popular with home affairs because you're messing up their systems, getting people to jump the queue and things like that, because they've got problems with their systems. I would have thought that what would have been useful for the Commission would have been some kind of analysis of the complaints, and that's what we would like to have seen, some kind of analysis of the complaints, and then the action that you're taking to try and address the systemic problems that have given rise to those complaints. So obviously it's important to deal with each person's individual problem, but also to look at a longer term solution, and you're properly placed as the Commission and differently placed to anyone else to do that, with the exception possibly of the Public Protector and the Commission for Gender Equality. But also one would expect, I know the Public Protector deals with home affairs matters. Is the liaison, is the coordination, or are you both basically both doing the same thing but separately and not addressing? The key thing, obviously, is to address the problems, but also to look at the systems so these complaints stop occurring. So, but I do think I agree with Mr. Sibagnoni. I think that the way you've done the presentation and the report, the sort of three parts of it is very useful. But in your annual report, I would have liked to have seen an analysis of the complaints. That's basically one. On the litigation side, do you have any relationship with Legal Aid South Africa? I hear the points you're making about the questions being asked of, is litigation effective? One would hope that litigation is used as a last resort, where you actually feel you can't get anywhere, because you're basically litigating against government, where you feel you can't get anywhere from the relevant government department or municipality or whatever. But aside, you said you're using pro bono, and then there are bodies like the Legal Resources Center, but the Legal Aid South Africa, I didn't hear any mention of them. They are starting to do
civil litigation, one would have thought that you know that there's plenty of room to engage them on whether they can assist where you do need to go to court. Then with a community outreach, I don't know what the budgets for those are, but they generally tend to be quite expensive. You had 74. How do you select the community? Now, xenophobia is a problem. There was a problem specifically at the Duins. Was that one of the communities that you engaged? Is there an attempt to say, look, in this area, there is a problem with, on the xenophobia issue, there is a problem with Somali traders. Let's engage this community on this issue. Is that the way you're approaching it, or is it more arbitrary than that? And you can sort of see there might be a problem with, I mean, maybe it's more than going on the Gender Commission, but there might be a problem with cultural practices in the Eastern Cape. Do you engage communities there? Is it linked to some overall objective that you're trying to reach? And then I think the other thing is suggestions. These are more suggestions, I suppose. With regard to Parliament, I mean, you haven't done a economic, socio-economic rights report for some time. You say it's going to be ready in November or early next year. And there's a general, legitimate, I think, complaint about Parliament, or it actually really should be the National Assembly, because that's who you're accountable to, not Parliament so much as a whole. But I think it would be useful that rather than just sending the report to the Speaker and saying, here's the report. And I think you're well placed, Chair, Deputy Chair, CEO, in terms of knowledge of Parliament and its workings, to actually say, look, rather, and there is this now, this Chapter 9 body in the Deputy Speaker's office, to work out a plan for how you want the socioeconomic report to be dealt with. So I would have thought that, for example, that instead of just sending it, that you organize, you say you want a briefing. You want to be able to brief a Parliament on it, and it would be particular portfolio committees that it affects, and that is organized. So it's not just something that comes with a myriad of other papers that we have to read and often battle to get through, but there's an event where you present to the relevant portfolio committees, and you're clear what you're looking for, what you're wanting. I also do have a bit of a problem. I mean, I know I've raised it with the PIA issues, and it is there in your report, which municipalities, who's not performing. But on the socioeconomic side, you know, we're here to assist you. So it would have been useful, while the process was still ongoing, for there to have maybe been a letter from the chairperson to the speaker to say, look, these government departments are not responding. Please assist us. Speaker could have then tabled it, referred it to portfolio committees, referred it to the leader of government business, whatever. But I think that whilst your concerns about not getting enough assistance from the National Assembly are valid, I think also you could be more forthright in terms of what you want. And there's within the Commission, quite a strong understanding of how Parliament works, both the National Assembly and the NCOP. So just those are really suggestions that I'd wanted to make. But I think if we could have it, it's ending up, look, there's not much to really engage you on. Maybe also to say with the request that you wanted to come later, this is on your annual report. We've got to do it in terms of Parliament's timetable at this stage. I think what would be useful is for you to come back after you've had your evaluations and your that whole program, and then brief us. We are wanting, as you know, quarterly reports. So maybe brief us as part of one of the quarterly reports on that whole process. But I think that's a different input to what you're doing now. This is a looking back, assessing, in spite of the questions that we're asking, which I suppose are suggestions for the way forward, this is a looking back. But I would you like to respond to those points?
Okay. So perhaps I'll start and then hand over to my colleagues and commissioners to deal with some of the questions. Firstly, thank you very much. I think those questions are touch at the heart of the issues. The first question relates to the criteria which we decide to determine what is a human rights violation or not, and who makes that decision. That's a critical question. Now, our complaints handling procedure, which is gazetted, speaks of any right contained in Chapter 2 of the Constitution. So a fundamental right which has been violated is the right, which is the kind of complaint that we deal with as a Human Rights Commission. However, you'll see that we received about 9,300 complaints. Many of those are labor-related complaints. Many of those also deal with prisoner complaints, and those are often referred to other institutions who are better placed to deal with those. I can give you a sense of the top 10 complaints that we deal with, and this is for the current financial year, the first quarter of 2010-2011. I must indicate that the reason why we didn't have those categories of complaints in the 2009-2010 report was because part of the challenges in collating those statistics, we have addressed those challenges for the current financial year. And unfortunately, this is part of the reason why we can't give you specific categories of complaints for the financial year under review. But I can talk about the top 10 complaints. So equality is number one. Arrested, detained, and accused persons is the second one. Just administrative action is the third. And then we also deal with other complaints relating to housing, labor relations, human dignity, freedom of expression, etc. Those are more or less the kind of complaints that we deal with at the Human Rights Commission. And this was for the first quarter. Yes, yes. thank you for throwing that in there, Chairperson. In terms of trends and what can be done about those trends, I think that's an absolutely critical question, and it also relates to the categories of complaints. So what we are trying to do for this financial year is to determine what the top 10 complaints are, identify where those complaints are coming from, and then try and engage with other programs in the Commission, such as research and such as education, to try and ensure that if there is a complaint, for example, around access to education, that we then follow up with community activities, which workshops and engaging with those particular communities where there are problems identified. Part of the problem, and I must acknowledge this up front, is that what's been happening at the Commission is that we have our programs that work, unfortunately, in silos. So the one program doesn't know what the other is doing, and complaints deal with complaints, education deals with education, and there is very little interaction between the two programs. And we've tried to start addressing those by getting programs to work together. The idea, for example, is for research to go out into a community, conduct research on a particular challenge, and this may be access to education again, if we use as an example. We then have workshops which will be run by our education program on access to education, and then we have our complaint handling people, the legal services program, go in and register and take complaints relating to this particular problem. So there is interaction and collaboration across the various programs. One of the issues is the complaint handling mechanism, which I also alluded to in my report, and this is again going to be discussed at our midterm strategic review during the course of the day tomorrow. But the challenge is that we haven't been dealing with systematic problems in the way which the chairperson has indicated. We have really been dealing with complaints almost on an ad hoc basis. There's just an overwhelming amount of complaints that we've received, and I'm not sure that we've managed to internalize those and that we've managed to think through the long-term strategies for dealing with these particular complaints and how to systematically deal with these complaints. I think that's been a challenge. The second challenge is our liaison with other Chapter 9 institutions, and again, the Chair alluded to this. I think that we have had, again, ad hoc relationships with the Commission on Gender Equality, the CRL Rights Commission, as well as the Public Protector. I attended a workshop yesterday, in fact, on good governance, which the Public Protector had organized, and again there we started talking about concretizing areas of collaboration between institutions supporting democracy. So the short answer is we have not been doing enough in terms of dealing with systemic problems and in terms of categorizing our complaints, but we have acknowledged this as a problem and we are trying to address this going forward. in terms of staff rates between 2005 and 2010, unfortunately, I don't have those figures with me. I think part of the reason for the increase in the overall expenditure relating to staff has been a number of staff that have joined the commission. Part of it, of course, the salary increases and adjustments, housing adjustments, housing allowance adjustments at least. The high staff turnover, and I think this is a complex issue, we have been having exit interviews. Part of the problem lays squarely at the door of the way in which our senior management has been operating at the commission. And this is something I take full responsibility for. I think the way in which senior managers have been dealing with staff is highly problematic, and this is something which I'm addressing through the restructuring process. Part of the problem is simply that we can't afford to hold on to top staff. So the chief financial officer post, for example, is a good one, where he joined our commission on the same day I did. He realized that he could get paid more elsewhere. He was hoping to negotiate for a higher salary. We simply couldn't afford to pay him more, and he decided to leave the commission. So while some of the problem lays squarely at the door of senior managers and the way in which we deal with staff, other problems are simply that we aren't able to pay our staff at the kind of salaries that they deserve. The three provincial managers who are leaving, and luckily Mpumalanga is not one of them, but the three provincial managers who are leaving, he's one of the people are from the Eastern Cape, and he's going to the CEO Rights Commission as their new CEO. So clearly he's going to be earning more money there. The provincial manager in the Western Cape who will be leaving us at the end of this month is actually going to the Legal Aid SA. So he will be joining them, again, at a higher salary. So part of the reason why people leave is because of salary, but also because of institutional reasons, which we are addressing at the moment. Which government departments have not been cooperating? I think that's the question I will give to commissioners to deal with. I think they've been more closely dealing with the government departments, and I don't have the answers to that. The Mpumalanga question I've dealt with. Interviews with radio stations in indigenous languages, absolutely. This is exactly what we're doing. We have, for example, just signed an agreement with a community radio station in KwaZulu-Natal, which is Zulu-speaking. So we have individuals who are identified in the commission who will be conducting interviews in indigenous languages. We don't simply deal with interviews from radio stations in English. And we have actually been trying to utilize community radio stations to get our message out to people in the rural areas, and we find that using radio stations are one of the best ways to do so. We realize it's not enough, and so we've also followed up with workshops in those rural areas. But again, we have one education officer in a province, and if you take a province as large as the Northern Cape, for example, it's just simply very difficult for one person to try and reach all of those rural areas in the Northern Cape. So again, limitations, financial constraints, human resource constraints, but we are trying to do the most that we can with the little that we have. Your question about CSAC, I know what you're talking about, it's the one that dealing with the protection of the Constitution. We were actually invited as a commission to attend this meeting, and one of our commissioners, Danny Titus, attended this particular meeting. I know they've indicated that they want to collaborate more closely with Chapter 9 institutions. We haven't formally engaged with them besides one of our commissioners attending that particular meeting. And the question was, how do we see our future collaboration with these organizations, and particularly civil society organizations? I think that's a critical question. There are certain things that we can't do as a Chapter 9 institution. We are not civil society, and so we can't say the kinds of things that civil society organizations say. We have a different mandate. We can engage with the ministers, with governments, with the president, and this is what we try and do. We try and play an intermediary role between the people on the one hand and government on the other, where civil society has a slightly different role. But working and collaborating with civil society, I think, is an absolutely critical and important component of our work. We have signed certain memoranda of understanding with international civil society organizations, for example, dealing with torture, but we do need to look more closely at working with civil society organizations locally and nationally, and this is something that we're definitely going to be taking into consideration. In terms of litigation, do we have a link with Legal Aid SA? I'm not sure that we have formal links with Legal Aid, but we have certainly engaged with them on various cases. As I indicated, our provincial manager in the Western Cape will be joining Legal Aid SA at the end of this month, so So again, we've got a strong connection with them and a more formal link with them. One of our commissioners, Janet Love, is also the head of the Legal Resources Center. So we also have a strong relationship with them. We've been working with colleagues at LRC on torture issues and investigations into the not detention centers, but the holding centers for foreigners. But there is certainly room to engage further with the Legal Aid SA and with the LRC. In terms of community outreach, I think there are two ways in which we approach community outreach. One is proactive and the other is reactive. Proactive engagement involves identifying a particular issue in a community and then going out there to talk to them about it. For example, in the Eastern Cape, there was a whole question around witch hunting, which was a major challenge in some of the rural areas in the Eastern Cape. And so we took initiative to go out there and actually talk to communities about this particular challenge. But a lot of our community interactions are also reactive. So we get asked by communities if we have a problem, can we call on the commission to talk to us about various issues, and certainly we do so. The way in which we've gone about our community interactions, however, as I indicated during my presentation, is far from perfect. It's problematic in certain instances because we are unable to measure and monitor and evaluate the impact of those interactions. And this is something that we're currently looking at. We are trying to develop monitoring and evaluation tools so that before there is a community interaction, we engage with the community, determine the level of awareness and understanding about a particular issue. We then have our community engagement and then assess how effective that community engagement has been after the fact. I unfortunately don't have specific answers on the De Duyns matter. I'm not sure the commissioners may be able to advise on that, but I can also get back to you on those questions. And then lastly, there were questions around the engaging with government departments and the inability, or at least the recommendation that the chairperson writes to the speaker to try and get government departments to engage with us. I think, again, on that question, I'm going to ask the chair and colleagues to have to...
A suggestion rather than a question.
Okay.
So I think it's just take it as a suggestion,
sure.
And then maybe if you think it's of any value, you could discuss it in your meetings.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just pick up on some things that I think he may have left out, and the Deputy Chair will do the same. The specific question which the Honourable Member there asked as to who decides whether or not this is a human rights violation. We do have a legal service department. Where all the complaints are analyzed and what have you, and they make recommendations to us, and the commissioners have got the final say whether or not this is a human rights violation. At times, it is difficult in the beginning to determine whether or not this is a real human rights violation, and it normally takes maybe a month or so while getting more information around the complaint, you know, to determine whether or not there is sufficient evidence to make a determination. For instance, take the very controversial matter of the Hout Bay. The mere fact that they have reported that matter to us, it's not in itself saying, no, look, we have said this is a human rights violation, but you have a lot of allegations out there which may suggest that if these facts are true, there will obviously be a human rights violation. But it will take a much longer time for the Human Rights Commission to finally say, look, there was indeed a human rights violation. So we first collate information around the complaint before we actually even decide whether or not to conduct a full investigation. So our experience is that sometimes, because a matter is with the Human Rights Commission, you know, people start complaining even before we acted. I mean, like now, we haven't done anything other than simply looking at what people are saying. We've got our team going out there to get information for us. And once they get this information for us, we are going to analyze them and then make a pronouncement that from the preliminary assessment that we've got, there are merits that we can conduct an investigation in this matter. So it's not always so easy to determine whether or not there is a violation, but we do make our own assessment and take decisions as commissioners. Staff are there to assist us, but the final decision lies with commissioners. There was a specific question once again around which department specifically are not cooperating with you. I'll just give an example. For instance, we issued the xenophobia report. I think it was around April. I was new in the commission, and we invited almost all the departments who were involved or who were touched on by the report, like safety and security, home affairs, justice. And up to now, for instance, the responses that we received from those departments were solely from, I remember, I think it's the police, and then we got a formal acknowledgement from the Justice Department. And all other departments who were directly affected have not come back to us. For instance, there was a lot that we did not have information of, the security services in the near the section. They have not said anything around that, what affects them. But because we met with a security cluster, which consists of the various ministries, and they are undertaking to respond to the report as a whole, I think we are on trend like that. But so far, we have not kept strong statistics in terms of which department is not complying or responding timely. But there are quite a number. Maybe what the challenge to us is to make sure that we compile those statistics, and the recommendation that the chair is making around those particular departments is something that is going to go a long way, because sometimes it takes a much longer period to investigate cases simply because of lack of responses. I mean, we have a number of complaints in the Gauteng province, for instance, relating to housing, with some of which are more than 5 years long before I was there, and they are still there. And when you check and follow up, is due to lack of responses. So it's something that we have come to discover as the incoming commissioner and the CEO, and this is helping us in terms of how we should go about addressing them. And maybe to add, Kwamhlanga, we don't have an office in Kwamhlanga, Honorable Member, it's the public protector. Maybe you're talking to me as a public protector. I had an office while I was the public protector there. But there is space for human rights. What we have done, we each time we get offices for public protector, we make room. So it's a challenge that maybe we as human rights will also go and occupy some of the open spaces. I know we have, I told the CEO, we also have a space in George where we can go as a human rights and occupy them as soon as we have staff. That is another way of trying to collaborate. Because in some cases, you know, this ad hoc basis of investigating cases is problematic and more expensive. But if we collaborate, we'll find in one matter, you need the public protector, you need the gender, you need so and so. And when these people report cases, the tendency is to report to each one of these institutions. I mean, like we have just discovered, you know, going to Out Bay, you find every possible institution is there. And at the end of the day, you don't even know how you should deal with it. So it is important, I think, this unit within Parliament dealing with the institution promoting democracy, it's going to be quite helpful. Collaboration is very important in this complaint, because you'll find that in a protest march, for instance, on service delivery, some will be claiming human rights violation. Some will be saying lack of delivery, which is a matter for the public protector. Some will be claiming the police were violent. That's an ICT matter. So there is a strong need of collaboration between these institutions, in particular in terms of addressing this complaint, because if we go individually, it takes much longer to get the relief that the community wants. I think it's a challenge which we have come to realize. And therefore, there is a meeting of Chapter 9 institutions, Chapter 9 and related institutions, which include the Public Service Commission, to try and find a way to deal with the complaints in that manner. We have seconded one of our commissioners into this particular body to begin to formalize our collaborations with that. I'm happy the chair raises issues around the trends of complaints, systemic investigation. That's the one thing that I've noticed that we are, that the Human Rights Commission has not been doing that, and I think we need to do that much more. It's something that I'm taking as a challenge that we need to introduce as well there. The question around litigation, whether we are using legal aid, this is still a much bigger challenge because, as you know, litigation is quite expensive. And the fact that our recommendations are merely recommendations and not binding. And my observation is that once you make a finding, departments are very reluctant to say they attack you rather than dealing with the problem. And the only way of getting things done is to go through the courts and make it binding. There is a temptation to move that route. But we also think that litigation is not always the best route to follow. Who would want to see a situation where we unite communities? Because a finding in a court of law does not restore peace and justice within the community. It might increase the fight between the council and the local community. It's something that we really desire to move towards. But some of the complaints are over-politicized to the extent that even when you try to mediate, because there's a trend to score political points on some of the complaints, people become reluctant to even agree to a mediation because they want to maximize whatever they want to pursue. So it's a much bigger challenge which places us as a commission in a difficult situation because we don't want to be seen to be pushing anybody's line of political ideology or practices. But at the same time, at the center of this is the people at the grassroots level who suffer. So that for us, it doesn't matter to which political affiliation you belong, but what matters most is service delivery at the lowest level. And I like the idea of the ESR report. That's one of the reasons why we have not released that report, because we spent some time trying to analyze what is in the report and what is it that it will say, because it's a very old report. You're right to say that that report has not been submitted to Parliament for a very long time. Some of the issues that are raised there have already been corrected. So as we are about to table it, we discover that there are areas where some of the things are history. And what do we do? Going forward, we have decided that we would want, in terms of the Constitution, to make sure that the report is tabled on an annual basis. And along the routes that you're suggesting, I think it will help more. Because part of the problem was that you write to departments, you want them to give you details of how they dealt with socioeconomic issues, and you don't get a response. So your suggestion is much more helpful, and we'll take it from there. Let me leave it for the deputy if she has anything.
Thanks very much, Chief. I think just a few things to add on. Thanks very much, I think, in relation to the ESR report and the proposal of how Parliament could actually assist in ensuring that one, departments cooperate and provide information that's needed, and two, that the findings are taken further through the various committees via a letter to the minister. I think just in relation to the role that Parliament plays in supporting institutions, supporting democracy, like the Human Rights Commission. One of the key questions is what is the role of Parliament in relation to the findings of the Commission? So, for example, we deal with a complaint. Let's take the complaint around sanitation. We deal with the complaint. It has two components to it. The one component of the finding is related to the specific municipality. The other component of the finding relates to national government and national government's role in ensuring that sanitation upholds dignity throughout the country. What is the role of Parliament in ensuring that that finding is taken further and implemented both by the municipality and by national government? And it's a question that I'm putting to yourself as the committee. The second area that I wanted to look at is just the whole question of systemic problems versus individual problems, and I think that really is also about how the complaints get handled, because what we've been trying to do is actually say, when there are specific complaints that come to us, how do we ensure that in addressing that specific complaint in that specific locality, that we also look at what is the systemic problem throughout the country in relation to that particular issue or that particular right. And so that the way in which we address the complaint is not just so localized that it actually loses sight of the context within which that problem exists. So I think just to reiterate that it's the way in which we try to begin to move as the Commission, that it's something that needs to be consolidated, and I think we'll take that into the strategic workshop, as well as the question of the selection of community. How do we select communities in terms of community outreach will be something that we will address in the strategic workshop in terms of commissioners' plans around the different areas that we take the responsibility for. In relation to just two specific questions, one was the Duans. I know that the Western Cape office did a significant amount of work and spent a significant amount of time, and I think it might be useful for a brief report on that to be shared with the committee. The second is in relation to CASAC, and apart from the invitation that was extended to the Human Rights Commission, which the Human Rights Commission accepted, I think it's as the Human Rights Commission, what we said is that we welcome the formation of the structure because it can play a role that the Human Rights Commission can't play, and it would complement that role, and that in relation to strengthening Chapter 9 institutions, it can play a really important role around, for example, the questions of what has Parliament done around the independent panel's report around the review of Parliament, the ASMO report, and the extent to which that has been if given effect to, which are aimed at strengthening, particularly those things that are aimed at strengthening or that will have the effect of strengthening Chapter 9 institutions, such as the Human Rights Commission. I've had an informal discussion with some of the leadership of CAFAC in terms of putting that to them, that it's actually really critical that they are able to play that role in terms of supporting the work of the Commission. The last thing I wanted to just raise was the issue of, and I suppose it links to the question of when we do reports, or when we, and whether those reports are annual reports or reports in relation to specific issues such as, or rights such as health, what does Parliament do when we come to this committee? What does it do with those reports? So, for example, the annual report of the Commission for several years has detailed in relation to PIA which departments have not responded, very detailed in terms of not just national but also in terms of local government. What does Parliament then do with those reports? Because that figure of almost 80% non-compliance hasn't improved. And so what is the, so we provide our role as the Commission is to monitor. We're not in enforcement body.
it's the minister who has that power. And how does Parliament take the report that we've already submitted several years in a row and ensure that the that you exercise your oversight role in terms of PAYA? So I just like to raise those questions in addition to what has been said by the Chair and the CEO. Thanks very much, Chair.
You know, on the issue of reports issued by the Commission, you know, just to cite an example, when I met with the Minister of Health and discussing this infant mortality, you know, some of the things that he raised as the problems, I discovered that there is a report already which was issued by the Human Rights Commission, I think a year or two back. And nothing was done around that. And now we are beginning to see the results of what is in the report. In other words, there are issues that are reported on and we keep quiet around them and they come back to haunt us. And when we analyze xenophobia, we are happy that the police took some of the recommendations that were contained in the report. And that's why when it wanted to resurface this year, somehow it was possible to stop it immediately. So we are saying that there is value to some of these reports that are tabled in Parliament. But that value is lost the moment nobody follows them up. They are not being implemented. And if this committee can assist us in that respect, it's going to go a long way in assisting the community out there.
I think it's more of a discussion. Is the difficulty not that there's a gap between us as Parliament and yourselves? So, you know, let's take, for example, the sanitation report, human rights violation. You did. There was a bit of an engagement. Debbie, I can't remember if you were there. Dean was there. But there was a bit of an engagement with the committee over that before. But I haven't seen that report. I did try it when it came out to get it from your website. It wasn't there. I don't think it ever got tabled in Parliament. So, and I think the question is, and maybe it's something for you to look at in your midterm evaluation or whatever, your relationship to Parliament. I mean, if you look at your annual report, it is addressed to the Speaker from your acting CEO, and the chairperson's foreword is very much specific to Parliament. But the xenophobia report, for example, chairperson, that you say wasn't responded to, I don't remember us having got that. Maybe it was sent. But I think the two things would be, are you sending enough to Parliament or to the National Assembly? And two, don't just send. Specify what you want done. So as I've made suggestions on the socio-economic report, that I think you should say you want to be able to brief the relevant committees and, in fact, even have the ministers, those relevant ministers there. I would have thought with the xenophobia that maybe you should have, if that was sent to Parliament, maybe you should have done the same thing. On PAYA, yes, Deputy Chair, you're correct. That detail has been there. Here it is again. But nobody presented on it. Okay. CEO, you're new. I don't think anyone's presented on it before. I mean, it's interesting reading. I see that Honourable Sebanyoni, that there's a in Kangala District Municipality, I think you might have some links there, that it's page 167, that is down as a repeat offender for a municipality not complying. And then I see, you know, my current constituency and my former constituency are listed there. And I mean, definitely those are things that one would want to follow up. But that's just on an ad hoc basis. But I think the point I'm making is I think the break is coming in that maybe, and the suggestion I'm making is maybe the Human Rights Commission, with its knowledge and experience of Parliament, should also try and determine, set the agenda more for how you want Parliament to act. So it would be useful. Look, the whole issue of PIA is now with the promotion of access to personal Protection of Personal Information Bill, now another issue as to is it going to stay with the Human Rights Commission, is it going to go to the information regulator. But it would have been useful to have had a thorough briefing on this, to have invited the Cooperative Governance and the former provincial and local government department to come along as well, because it involves local government. So I think the suggestion is, I'm being a bit long-winded maybe, is that maybe you should be, are you sending enough to Parliament? And when you send to Parliament, don't just send, also indicate what you want done. And maybe this body in the Deputy Speaker's office will assist, but I think you could do a lot more. It's not trying to shift the buck. That's one. Then the other one was also, are you engaging government enough? So maybe you should, certain parties get quite reactive when they get criticized. Nobody likes to be criticized. So they sort of lash out, huh? All parties, okay. But some have been more in the news recently than others, okay, you know. Maybe, no, I don't, yeah, let's leave the parties. But because there's a lot been happening in this metro, has the Human Rights Commission looked at an engagement with the Cape Town Metro? If you've got a problem of non-compliance, are you engaging provincial governments, provincial legislatures? I know there's money involved in terms of you've then got to travel down there, but you're based in Gauteng. An engagement with the Gauteng legislature may be useful. I think you did it some time ago. I mean, historically, I mean, the commission. I seem to remember from KZN that we did get a briefing in the first 5 years from the commission. But maybe, you know, that might help with compliance issues. You could rope then in provincial legislatures into provincial compliance issues, not just on PIA, but on other aspects. And then maybe going for the metros, because they just, you know, so many people live in the metros, and then if there are particular local governments that seem to be having problems in their area, maybe engagements with them. So I would suggest that's another area that you could look at. Llewellyn, you had your hand up, and then Debbie.
Chairperson, thank you. Yes, I hear what you've said, and let me start by thanking everyone in the Commission for their presentation this morning. But I thought that what the Commission was asking us is, what are you planning to do? And the role of Parliament in the Commission's reports. There is a disjunction. I think we must concede to that. I think we should make a start, Chairperson, by saying that not just the Human Rights Commission, Public Protector, and whoever else appears before this committee, if they submit a report to us, then we would need to take that report and debate it, Chairperson, and determine, arising from that debate, determining the way forward. Too many reports are tabled in Parliament, and inevitably they end up in the wastebin. There are some that are given the necessary attention, probably because of the controversial nature of the subject matter. But other than that, most of them are just filed away. We rely on Parliament's library, and that's where they end up. Now and again, academics access them for their work, but that's it. I think also, Chairperson, that we would need to engage with that new body in the Deputy Speaker's office. I'm not sure just what their role is meant to be. They came about with hue and cry, with fanfare. What are they going to do, actually?
Yes, but what does that mean? What does that mean, actually? We're making a lot of assumptions, and my fear is that sometime down the road, there's going to be a gnashing of teeth, and people are going to try and tear their hair out again, simply because we made assumptions, and I really don't understand what they're going to do. I'd love someone to come and sit in front of me and say, well, this is what we plan to do. And it would be good for people like the Human Rights Commission to understand what their role is going to be. I think one of the difficulties, Chairperson, is that Parliament hasn't debated the Asmal report. It's a report that was tabled, and that's it. Professor Asmal himself has gone on record to lament the fact that if we don't like his report, then we must say that. But right now, all we're saying to him and everyone else involved is, well, okay, but, you know, we won't even read it. We won't even consider it. That's effectively what we've said to him. And he didn't do this on his own. He was asked to do it by Parliament. And I think in fairness to him and to the report, we would need to engage with the report. And if we don't like it, say so. I think at the very least that is what we should do. Some of the issues, I focus mostly on the prior part of the annual report. And some of the issues raised here are somewhat disturbing. I have a question or two that I'd like to raise. I understand the difficulties with Section 32 reports, because the Commission is now saying there's no sanction on public bodies which don't submit these reports, which requires an amendment to the Act, obviously. I'm impressed, Chairperson, by the fact that one of the consistently outstanding performances from a DIO, as a Deputy Information Officer, is a member of the South African Police Service. Now, the media often highlights all the negative aspects of things that take place in government. Here is something very positive, in my view. No one would have thought that someone from South African Police Service would have achieved such an award, together with the other, Anas Mabuza of Business Day, Ms. Maumela and Ms. Komomo, Tiavatis Kloof Municipality, Francis Bartis Kloof Municipality, all, I think I must say well done to them, and hats off to the Commission for these awards, which highlight the importance of PIRE. My question relates to the need for a review of the penalty provision for non-compliance, and this is in relation to Section 14, or were they referring to Section 32? Maybe it's the way I've read this particular paragraph. The Commission has requested clarity from the Department of Justice on the process of enforcing the penalty provision for non-compliance in Section 40. I would need someone to just explain to me what is meant there. There is a penalty provision in Section 14, so what is it that you're looking for, actually? If that could be just provided, Chairperson. The tables set out here are disturbing, Chairperson. Particularly where it says on page 162, all Chapter 9 institutions have been non-compliant with reporting obligations for more than 3 consecutive years. Now, I understand the Department of Public Works. I understand the Department of Corporate Governance, etc. I understand the Office of the Premier in KwaZulu-Natal, who, by the way, Chairperson, is a repeat offender. I'll understand other such bodies, public bodies, but okay, her too. But a Chapter 9 institution, Chairperson, No. Well, I don't know. They say all Chapter 9 institutions, well, that's a valid question. That's, are you including yourself there? So perhaps we need some clarity there. And I don't see a table here, so I'm not sure which table is being referred to here. There are other tables listing just about every single public body here, and we're grateful for that. Oh, I see. Okay. All right. They're just listed there. Fine. Be that as it may. But Chairperson, we're going to have to sit down as a committee and decide how we're going to deal with this. I would also urge, Chairperson, if I may, the Human Rights Commission to engage with the NCLP. And you've alluded to the fact that we have here members who understand the parliamentary processes. And the NCLP deals directly with provinces. And so they are able to call a province to account. And in this case, I can't see why. Failing which, we will have to decide how we do it. It's a huge number of people, Chairperson, and public bodies. And that is why I'm saying we would need to decide how to deal with it. If we don't do it, no one else is going to do it, Chairperson. I think that's the bottom line. So Chair, those are just a few of my comments. Thanks.
But maybe just I see Debbie and JB, and then the commission would want to respond. But I started by making the point of you never presented on this, but you haven't brought the right people. You've got two people involved. You didn't bring them from a cost point of view. But maybe what we should be doing to the committee is saying, look, let's have a session on this report. Yes, bring your people. Let's then invite the provincial and local government. Let's maybe, from a cost-saving point of view, do it with the NCOP, but let's engage with this report. I don't think we can properly engage with it now. So that would... No. But I'm just saying that I think would be a suggestion I'd want to make to the committee. Debbie, it's your turn then.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You open the issues now, you're going to have to deal with the consequences. If you want to start looking at calling people to account and perhaps going and engaging with different municipalities and provinces, you should perhaps start first with the Limpopo province, which has got 47% delivery in sanitation in the entire province, and Mpumalanga with 60% as opposed to the Western Cape's 93.6%. Secondly, as far as the metros are concerned, Western Cape has got Cape Town Metro is 93.9% sanitation access, whereas Mandaung has got 60%. So perhaps, first of all, look at those figures before you decide which ones you're going to start engaging with. Second of all, on a more serious note, well, that's a misstatement. Given that you say you don't want to be seen to be taking a political line, which we certainly welcome and look forward to seeing in your recommendations and how you deal with your complaints, how do you justify refusing to investigate 11 examples of serious sanitation problems in almost all other provinces of the country, which the DA gave to you in June this year, which you refused to investigate? How do you justify that when it was so quickly done in the city of Cape Town? I'm afraid that kind of thing leads to the questions that are being asked at the moment. Can you please give us an answer on that, Mr. Advocate Mishwana? And then I'd also just like to ask, seeing as the advocate raised the issue too, on the issue of Hungberg. You're right, none of us like to be criticised. I don't think any party likes to be criticised. But we're quite prepared to accept criticism if it's valid and if it's consistently done. Was Hungberg reported to you, or was it an investigation on your own? And depending on your answer, then I might have a follow-up.
So thank you, Chairperson. In view of the fact that the Human Rights Commission will be having a mid-term strategic review tomorrow, I was very brief. Let me just start by saying my area is a Kangala, starting with an E, in Gauteng. So that one is in Kangala district in Mpumalanga. But exactly, Chairperson, before that's where we were, before the cross-border was disbanded. Is it Kumbini also here?
As a consistent non-performer.
Well, that's my consistency. want civil society. We don't want to hear anything from civil society. But I was pleased when, what is his name again? Kemal saying, we not necessarily support what these other organizations are saying, but we work with them, etc. You see, the Chapter 9 institutions, when democracy was achieved, we said, we put these Chapter 9 institutions, they are the institutions guarding constitutional supremacy and the like, and we felt that there are some guarantees so that the wrongs of the past will never happen again, as President Mandela said before. And nowadays, when we hear these voices saying the Constitution is under threat and the like, and when we look around and say, who is the culprit, and then the thing is pointing at us, we become worried to say, how can we be the culprit, you see? How can we be the culprit? Yesterday I said, the chairperson laughed when I said I was once a flamboyant and what lawyer. You know, we were, there were, in fact, there were no civil society, but you will find that there were some individuals, I would say legal practitioners and activists who were saying, but this thing is wrong. For example, I'll tell you, during the state of emergency, when you would go and get a person out on bail, and then you drive with your car before you reach your office, when you reach your office, you receive a phone that your client has already been arrested, and you drive back, you don't find him there. You look all the surrounding police station, you don't find where is your client, and the family is saying, you see, so-and-so, we want our person, you see. And then it is a time when we then started mobilizing lawyers together, and more especially when the penalty was used politically to some of our political activists and the like. It is when we said, no, we mobilized the lawyers, called them to this thing, to the church square, said, bring your gang. We were called lawyers, gang zabalas. And then nowadays, when people are saying, these people are a threat to democracy, we really get surprised. Why? Why shall we then start now be a threat to these rights that we fought so hard for? That is all she has.
Thanks. On the prior issues that you are raising, I think we'll prefer to consult with the person involved just to get more details so that will give a fully written response on the request to justice, exactly what is behind that. And we are going to send it back.
What I would suggest is rather they look at changing a meeting on fire. So don't attend the something, we'll have a meeting on fire before the end of the year, where we can get the presentation on the report, and we can come and work with the other bring it for that.
We definitely will do that. To my honorable member there, we did not decline any request to investigate. All we said is that we had already made a recommendation to the national minister, and we continue to do that. And we even wrote a letter to you thanking you for giving us those details that you are saying, to say this is the list that we are going to give the minister to make sure, because we're not looking at Cape Town. It's only that during the process, when we engaged on this particular issue, just close to Makassar, there were other areas with similar problems, and we felt this is not just a work for one council, but this is a national problem, which I think we need to make that recommendation, which still stands, by the way. to say in all of those areas where there are similar circumstances like the ones that are happening in Cape Town, we want the national minister to impose, and I'm sure to implement them. And that's why the deputy chair was saying, look, we are not only focused on one area. If we are busy, then we'll look at the country as a whole to avoid the reputation of going and investigate something that is clear. You send us photos, we have that. And we did respond, and we did tell you what we are doing. You insisted on one of them, the one in the Free State. We are busy investigating that. Because somebody sent it to say, no, look, because you did Cape Town, we want you to do it. And we're doing that. So I even made a suggestion to the Honorable Member Dean Smart to say, look, maybe what the chair said in terms of do we engage with each other. I think that for me that is very important, because you may be having a point, yes, but from our point of view, really, we can't sacrifice community. I mean, you cannot give us that information and we don't follow it up. We are following it up. And we can assure you that there is no way that we are going to leave that complaint that you gave to us. On the question, did you receive the outpay complaint? We received it. It's in writing. If you want to see the written complaint, it's there. We have received it. And we have even received the second one. Actually, it's four now, I'm told. We don't choose, you know, I was surprised to be told that we choose the areas of the... We don't choose. People came. We have not proactively investigated areas where it happens to be a DA government. No, it is the people themselves who came to us in all of these complaints. So rather than looking at DA, looking at the ANC, let us look at the people we are serving. Is this thing happening? Is it correct to have that type of toilets in the community? To us, that is the question, the critical question. And that's why we even recommended to the minister to say, look, don't look at Cape Town. Look at these other areas. Implement them. And our next move, if this matter was not taken to court, we were going to the minister to ask for the program of action in respect of all of those that list that you have sent to us. But the community already have put this matter in court. And we are meeting as commissioners to say, look, what do we do now? Because that matter has been taken out of our hands. It's a dynamic turn that this matter has taken. So we can debate it, but please, for the sake of the commission, don't take us to politics. Let us answer the question. Is this the right thing for the people at the grassroots level?
Thank you very much for that. And but my information is that you did refuse, and you said it was too many complaints to investigate. So are you now undertaking to make sure that you do investigate this complaint?
I will repeat. In our letter, we said we have already made a recommendation to the minister that in all of those areas where there are problems that were in your photos, you must follow them up. And then you came with this specific one in the Free State. Even your letter said, no, look, we agree with you on those ones that we have sent you, but we want you to investigate that one. And we are investigating it.
I just wanted to just reiterate a point in relation to a specific complaint around sanitation in the Western Cape. The Commission didn't choose to take up this issue in terms of sanitation in this municipality. It was a complaint that was brought to the Commission. And I think that is very important in relation to just looking at the Hout Bay one as another example. Where complaints are brought to the Commission, and the Commission actually makes a decision about how it will actually engage that complaint, I think we're guided not by party political consideration, which has been inferred very strongly over the last while, and which I think one of the issues that Parliament has to address is how does Parliament engage attacks on Chapter 9 institutions and on the integrity of Chapter 9 institutions. It's a question for Parliament to engage. And I think that there has to be also an overall context that has to be looked at in terms of the role of civil society. And where civil society is active and utilizes Chapter 9 institutions, is a Chapter 9 institution's integrity then going to come under question? So, for example, in this province, there are civil society organizations which utilize the complaints mechanism of the commission to lay complaints and link that to local issues which civil society is organizing around. So is the institution then, in fulfilling its mandate, held to be a politically biased in taking up this complaint? And I think the last point I want to raise is the point that I raised in the last meeting of this committee. If you look at the commission's record, in terms of taking complaints, in terms of all its reports, in terms of investigations, hearings, etc., you will find that almost, and if I'm not correct, Kim, as the CEO, you can correct me on this, but this finding in relation to the sanitation was the very first finding against the DA and not the ANC. Almost every single other finding has been against the ANC in government at national, provincial, or local level. So you look at all the reports, you look at it in terms of PAIA, in terms of socioeconomic rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in terms of complaints, that's the record. So the record is very clear. So in terms of political bias, the record speaks, I think, very clearly. Thanks very much, Chair.
So also to correct, though, the... You don't make findings, or the word findings against parties, you mean governments or local government or provincial governments in which a party or the DA is the majority versus in which the ANC is the majority.
Thanks for that correction.
In case anybody
else. Thanks for that correction.
Just to end on a positive note, I wanted to let the members know that this year's Golden Key Awards, the Promotion of Access Information Act Golden Key Awards, the city of Cape Town actually won for the best municipality in terms of compliance with PAIA. So, again, and that award was handed out by Commissioner Govender and myself to the city of Cape Town earlier this year, in fact, 2-3 weeks ago. They have accepted it, yes, yes. They were very happy about it.
Yeah, look, I think let's close at that point. But I do think the issue of, I mean, you know, it's embedded in our culture that you don't criticize judges. I mean, the laws, you're not by law meant to be criticizing. You're meant to be supporting a Chapter 9, as you're meant to not be criticizing judicial decisions. And that's generally accepted. And obviously the courts rule against, I mean, I see they made a ruling recently that was not liked by a party. Overberg. Sorry. But anyway, I suppose I shouldn't be joking on the point. But I think the difficulty is with the Chapter 9s, it's not there. And invariably, they get asked to arbitrate on effectively political issues. So I think the public protector was criticized recently for not finding against the president of the youth league, and so on, and it's maybe something. It might be useful if you also include that in your report, you know, so that there's a basis on which we can discuss. Because at the moment, apart from the verbal discussions that we've had here, and I think you know, the issue came up more with Ms. Smuts when the CEO was talking about, and he, I thought, raised it in quite a balanced way at the last meeting. The last presentation to the committee, the whole issue of access to water and the whole issue of taps that cut water off after a particular amount is used. And he, you know, and a family where a large number of people lived, so the cutoff happened quite quickly. And he did raise it in quite a balanced way as to, you know, the problems of the municipality having to control its water versus the issue of the right.
But I think it's something that we do need to Debbie debate as Parliament. Yeah. But anyway, I think to thank you for your presentation. Maybe to say, which nobody really has done, I think the issue of the unqualified audit, particularly with the difficulties that you're facing with staffing and with short-term CFOs, is very commendable, and to keep that up, and hopefully we'll have a lot more space for further engagement, and you'll take some of the suggestions that have been made into your strategic planning discussions, and we would like to schedule. I mean, you're meant to be coming back to the, I think it's to the full committee on the whole issue of PIRA. I don't know if we've received your report yet, but we've then got to schedule a meeting. That's the issue of the location of PIRA. That's a different issue. I don't think we should combine that with the PIRA report that you've got here, because that's relating to the Protection of Personal Information Bill. But there would then be two further engagements, and then you're also looking for a third engagement, whether it's this year or early next year, on the outcomes of your strategic planning and where you're going. And then I think also look at those suggestions on the socioeconomic report, because a lot of the debates that have happened here could be taking place when that report is discussed. Llewellyn, you look like you wanted to say something?
Chair, there's a golden thread, if I refer to it in that way, in the Commission's report this morning, and it relates to the need for additional resources.
Mm.
As a committee, we're going to need to address that.
Mm.
We can't have them coming here and throughout their report,
mm.
it's repeated over and over, and with good reason, and we simply say nothing.
Yeah.
So
just look, we're going, as far as I know, Bonani, we're going to be discussing all these reports, what, next week? I think the and it may be something for the discussion. Obviously, they're under-resourced. They've always complained about that. But we had the issue yesterday from the Justice Department of not being able to build courts and having effectively to take money from the staff vacancies to fund other programs. The issue that was of the greatest concern for me was the staff retention issue, because I think also bodies have to look at, there was a quote that I think they had on the NPA report, which was attributed to the Minister of Finance of it wasn't anything about shuts, taps that have been switched off, but it was basically make do with what you've got. Legal Aid South Africa seemed to have done quite well with that, and because they've got a huge number of pressures on them, and they seem to be, well, keeping staff and poaching staff. But I do think the issue of the staff retention aspect is something particularly we need to address. But I think otherwise it would be, we are going to be, just for the Human Rights Commission, we are then going to be discussing all these reports. Legal Aid South Africa, the Department, NPA, yourselves, and the Public Protector next week, and we then will be reporting to the House, and it's no secret that you have no money. Briggs, sorry.
Chair, thanks. I think apart from staff retention, I think the issue of the implementation of PIRA, because I think if you've got a huge mandate, a significant mandate, an important mandate, particularly in light of questions around information and the current context of the other bills around protection of state information and then the personal information bill, the issue of the access to information is an incredibly important mandate. And to have to allocate 180,000 Rand to such a mandate, such an important mandate, to have one staff member and one intern, doesn't match up. I mean, I think the figures, at the end of the day, it's about, the figures speak about the priorities of a state. And I think those figures speak volumes. Thanks.
And also, I think, I would imagine, maybe it was something Munch had raised earlier, that the reason you haven't produced a socioeconomic rights report for how many years? Three. Is it only three? Okay. Is linked to resources. And the other rights and violations of rights regarding equality and police custody and so on are often easier to deal with than the socioeconomic rights because they are very much resource linked. And so it is a great pity that that hasn't been able to come out, and you do need you do need resources for that function as well. So yeah, I think those are noted. But this isn't the end of a process. There will be a report. The report would then be going to the House. Unfortunately, every other portfolio committee is also reporting. So I think the chances of any debates on those reports are going to be quite limited. Those reports will be accepted. There may be recommendations which are accepted. If there's requests for further money, then in terms of the Money Bills Amendment Act, that goes to the Minister of Finance if accepted by the House. So it's not the end of a process, but we then do need to look at Llewellyn's points on more detailed debate on the Human Rights Commission, because you're more than a department. Who had the hand? Christine? Debbie? No, okay. All right, well, if we've reached the end, to thank the chair, the deputy chair, the CEO, the acting CFO, for attending.